A new age of reason. Brain treason to trick the mind. What good is searching if nothing's there to find? We arrive at this place of no return, my brothers, only to discover that our minds have left so way. The nonprofits, and you're not. Granted, other people may have atheist podcasts, but they don't have me, Dennis Lube, or Matt Dillahunty.
Hello.
Or Schilling.
Yes.
Or even Russell Glasser.
Not me either.
As their hosts. And they may broadcast like us, but I bet not on Saturday, the 19th of January, 2008, or from the Dillahunty International Studios in Austin, Texas. And they sure as hell don't have a cool opening music like us, like the Epiphany by Bad Religion. I'm sure some have sponsors, but none are like the atheist community of Austin. Okay, they may be nonprofit organizations like the ACA, but they can't really promote positive atheism or the separation of church and state like we can. So, you can find more information about our obviously superior sponsor on the ACA voicemail at 512-371-2911, or the website at www.atheist-community.org. And our Atheist Happy Hour at 7 o'clock on Thursdays at the Dog and Duck is happier than any other Atheist Happy Hour, because we're happier atheists. Really. So there. We're better because we broadcast every other Saturday from 2 to 3:30. No other atheist podcast can claim that. And believe me, our chat room is vastly superior to any other atheist podcast chat room, and you can prove it to yourself by visiting www.nonprofitsradio.com and following the directions to participate in the show. So unlike all other atheist podcasts that try to be cool, prepare to be entertained and educated by the nonprofits.
Amen.
Amen.
And amen with the mic on. The first one didn't count.
Oh.
You know, I have to say, we keep getting, of course, comments and compliments about the intros that Dennis comes up with, and I'm always baffled because I had to run out of ideas a long time ago. And yet they just keep on coming, and they're great.
And that was my special pleading intro.
So how's everybody doing?
Oh, fine.
Pretty good.
I thought I was going to be so unprepared for this show, but all the paper came out, and got all my stories and stuff ready to go, so I'm here.
Cool. Anybody do anything exciting in the past 2 weeks? Come on, we're supposed to be the happier atheists. Clearly, we must have done something, you know.
Well,
I played a lot more games than I have in 2 years.
A couple of people did some pretty neat things in
the
last 2 weeks.
The whole wedding thing.
Oh yeah. The whole reason we shifted to nonprofits 1 week was to do this wedding thing. So actually, and they're both here.
Yeah,
Schilling and Sandra. We married them off last Saturday instead of doing a nonprofit show. And actually,
we should have done one live on the air.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would have worked out real well. There was some people who. People are probably more coherent today than they were for the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. But during the wedding, would have been cool. I mean, you know, they're standing at the altar. Yes, they're getting married. It's golf clap. Yay.
And now for the traditional broadcast of the consummation.
I enjoyed it because it was actually my first kind of official wedding, which was cool. And,
And you did conduct the wedding.
Yeah.
You did the...
I said some words and then stood there and looked awkward while they said words. But no, the sermon, for lack of a better word, and I'm sure some atheist out there just cringed, but screw you. The sermon portion of the wedding that I had put together actually is going to be reprinted in the ACA newsletter for February. And I realize it doesn't get mailed out to everybody. But what you may not know is that if you go to the ACA website, you can actually look at a PDF online version of the newsletter for, I guess, for every month. So
yeah,
look for the February one when it comes out. There's going to be a picture. I had a good time.
I heard it was very nice.
Yeah. This is the groom speaking.
The night before involved a lot of stupidity and a concussion. So my memory is fairly vague.
Yeah, and he's not at all joking. Monday morning after suffering with headaches and nausea for a couple days,
yeah,
I
attributed it to paying the piper for 15 pints on Friday. I figured it was just a bad hangover, and it didn't go away. So found out it was a concussion.
And we got to spend our Monday in the emergency room. Or he spent his Monday in the emergency room. I spent it in the waiting room watching the Golf Channel.
Yeah.
You didn't pray?
No.
Cool.
I considered it, but then I realized that I'm sane.
I'm attacking religion again.
Clearly, one of those.
I'm pretty sure with some of Sandra's family there, there was plenty of praying going on during the ceremony,
and I imagine some of it might have been panicked prayer. But you know, like I said, one of the first goals that I had was to try and put people at ease and not, I even said nice things about a pope. I mean, come on now.
What proportion in attendance were actually of the religious persuasion?
Proportionally.
20,
less than 10%.
I don't know, because I don't know how many of her family and your peeps are religious at all.
I'd say we had about 10% religious folk.
Okay,
there was a lot of ACA folk there, but I did say nice things about a pope, particularly Pope Innocent III. But you can read more about that in the newsletter.
But what have the popes done for us lately?
Well, I
imagine the humor level that we've had. Uh-huh. Minus popes, that's a significant blow.
Yeah,
we
have a lot of mileage
on
the popes.
We'd always have presidents.
Oh boy,
candidates.
Yeah, but we got to be careful. We got to tiptoe around presidents.
So now we're back and rambling. So
yes,
and we don't need to ramble because we have like all kinds of news stories and
Email.
Yes. I'm sure there were plenty of people we pissed off over this whole animal rights thing that we.
Oh, we get mad.
On the
we
one didn't, hand, didn't really treat I understand that we probably pissed off a lot of people, and I'm always up for a discussion about it. But it's so tangential.
Yeah,
it's probably best not to address.
I don't want to spend
to the last show, and I was actually a little more irritated with your comments on children, but the animal thing, no problem.
So would you save the child before the tiger cub?
Fuck yes.
See? At least one of us is, has
in fact, to the point where I was wondering if you guys were being ironic in some way.
Well, you have children's.
But anyway, like Shilling was saying, it's kind of tangential. It doesn't really have any – it's interesting and, honestly, my opinion wasn't well-formed beforehand, and I'm not sure that it's a lot better formed now, but –
There is though one pretty decent connection that's come up on the Iron Chariots forum regarding this, mm-hmm. And it hasn't been discussed directly, but the whole PETA thing is based on this idea that humans are somehow greater than or separate than the rest of nature. It's based on this idea that our actions should be changed simply because we're aware of what those actions mean.
I don't totally disagree with that.
That, humans are omnivores. I don't give a shit what someone wants to eat or doesn't want to eat. As beings, we're omnivores.
Well, look, I think that if you would talk to Richard Dawkins, for example, he would say that evolution is not a moral imperative. And now
right.
that we're aware of the kinds of things we, we are driven to do and why, we are better able to maybe decide which of those behaviors we want to change and counteract.
I agree.
I'm not a vegetarian.
Right.
I agree. And I think overcoming our nature is one of the things that makes us Well,
smart.
I was going to say better. Being able to transcend your nature and make choices that affect things is what makes us unique, at least on the planet, or at least.
Oh, Dennis is scowling. Here we go.
but my objection isn't to this idea within PETA that we're superior, can make the choices. My objection is that they claim that we've done some fundamental wrong by domesticating certain animals.
Right.
And yeah. That we somehow tinkered with nature and we shouldn't do that. That all these other animals should be left to their own devices. And I know that's kind of an oversimplification of the argument they're making. But however they phrase it, I just don't buy it.
Well,
show me that the animals are worse off and that, in fact, we're not actually creating something better in a broader sense. If you, for example, think that the ability to reason, work for peace and avoid conflict and struggle is a positive thing, then clearly domesticated animals are superior to their wild, throat-ripping cousins.
Well, with the argument the thing you mentioned just a second ago, of us tinkering with things. Like natural selection is not simply guided by environment. It also has to do with social interactions with other species. So species are affecting the evolution of other species at all times. Just because we are a hell of a lot better at it and understand what we're doing doesn't mean that we should avoid doing it at all costs. It's something that happens naturally. So I just think it's a matter of we are a lot better at affecting the evolution of another animal and affecting it in a way that we can control to a pretty good degree.
But, and I, well, not to step on what Russell's about to say, but I think our ability to predict and understand the consequences of our behavior and the impact, broad spectrum,
right,
obligates us to take the actions that are best in whatever arbitrary
right. I think actually I would have two arguments with that. One of them is that there could be long-term consequences in the sense that, you know, we might be better in terms of, say, driving other species to extinction. But I mean, my major concern if that were to happen would primarily be that if you screw with, the proportion of animals that are alive, you might wind up screwing with the conditions that actually make our lives possible
right.
to handle things.
And I wouldn't advocate screwing around with it indiscriminately or anything
right.
like that. But if you're talking about something like domesticating animals, that's something where we can see the yeah. long-term consequences very easily. We're not removing species. We're just sort of adding
right.
a new branch on the evolution. I think that it's something that we have a lot. There's very little room for error in domesticating an animal. Aside from the pure fact that you're tinkering, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Well, there are unexpected consequences.
I don't think there's anything wrong with
tinkering. There are unexpected consequences, but that's not to say that they're necessarily going to be negative or that you should assume that they'll be negative.
Yeah, I mean,
there are
consequences
unexpected
consequences to getting out of bed every morning.
I'd say that to kind of throw a bone to both sides of the and to challenge both sides of the argument, it may be the case that we've simply – that both sides are relying on an arrogant presumption about our capability of predicting – consequences. The animal rights, let's not have pets argument, seems to presume either with a basis that there's some natural plan or natural design which is intrinsically superior to other outcomes, or in assuming that our tinkering is not actually a natural and a part of this.
Well, not necessarily. I can see the argument they might make that they just think it's cruel and you should avoid cruelty. I mean,
but
that
argument is based on a ridiculous assumption that you can show in any way that it's cruel. We have no
right.
idea if the animal would prefer.
Yeah, I think the objection to keeping animals as pets is ridiculous.
And somebody posted that one of their primary arguments against keeping animals as pets is that we've basically created an industry where there's a whole bunch of unwanted pets that are discarded by not spaying and neutering pets. And I'll say that I advocate spaying and neutering your pets.
Yeah.
When that's going to happen in the wild.
Responsible pet ownership. If responsible pet ownership eliminates your objection, then, you know, hey.
Right. And likewise, you know, a lot of the objection to, say, the meat industry, where you have animals penned up and not able to move their entire lives, we should do something about that.
Yeah.
There could be considered a certain amount of misery
I would
in
say
that
no.
situation.
I think you could make an argument for it, but I would still say no. I think it's far less cruel to pen up a certain number of animals for an industry where you can feed a hell of a lot of people than to have several different slaughterhouses that are very inefficient.
But see, here's the problem.
That assumes that you couldn't do it as well without doing that.
Here's the problem with both of those arguments. Yeah. We just basically agreed a little while ago that we can't adequately assess cruelty from the animal's point of view. So for either side to say this is less cruel or this is more cruel, really doesn't apply in this.
To a certain extent, for like veal treatment, that's we can't know that that's cruel for the animal, but we have a pretty damn good idea.
Well, what we're really talking about is what are we comfortable with? What right. limits are we comfortable with?
Right.
And you know, it's kind of like saying, well, you can't prove love. Well, you can, and you it's one of those things where, on some levels, you know it when you see it. You see a mother with a newborn baby. You can look at her face and know that she loves that kid. And it doesn't matter if love exists.
Before you leave it in the burning building to save the tiger.
Well, let the mother carry it out if she loves it so much. But I'm just kidding. But being able to identify that, we can also look at animals and determine whether or not they're suffering, just like we can look at people and determine whether or not they're suffering. So
sure.
there are some identifying factors that we can use, but there are limits to what we can quantify. And I don't know that it ends up getting us anywhere in the discussion.
Right. Mm.
Not really. But, I mean, I'll just say that there are a lot of organizations we have that I do approve of, like the people who will come around and find out, you know, if you're beating and not feeding your dog, for instance,
yeah.
and say, sorry, you can't have this dog anymore.
Yeah, and we said pretty much unanimously that we were opposed to cruelty.
Right.
Cruelty to a single animal is much easier to determine than cruelty on a just species level. Like, it was cruel to domesticate cats and dogs to the point that we have. That is unfounded horseshit. I don't think you could point one way or the other on that.
And I'm not quite sure, after some more information, that that's really the argument that anybody's making. But anyway, we don't need to spend a whole other show on animal rights.
Sure.
Suffice it to say that we got some email and I had some good discussions, and there's some interesting follow-up discussions, and that's always good.
So do we want to go into news?
Do
we have any special announcements?
Well, I wanted to make an announcement on behalf of the Atheist Longhorns, since Sandra's in here probably staring at me.
They can't speak for themselves. We must speak
She's
for them.
She's actually the president of the Atheist Longhorns, which is an atheist organization on the campus of the University of Texas at Austin. And they're having their first meeting of the year Wednesday. When?
At 6.
In Welsh, 3.402. So if you're listening and you're a UT student, staff, faculty, I should have just handed you
custodian.
A mic. Yes, if you're...
Do you still type stuff into the chat room so it'll be available in the log later? So somebody type that.
Yeah.
Okay, type that into the log and I'll type it in here in a minute.
Yeah.
But also, in the March time frame, and we'll have more information as this gets closer, there's supposed to be a conversation between Richard Dawkins and Steven Weinberg.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
Here?
And it's here in Austin
totally
on the UT campus.
Yeah. At least for now, it's It's joint between CFI and the Atheist Longhorns, I believe.
Ha! Atheism in your face.
And there's, yeah, there's another student group as well. And honestly, you know, I don't
splitters.
I don't care if the KKK brought them to town and set up this discussion. The discussion itself is going to be good, and I'm looking forward to it. We'll get more information on that. I'm going to go type this info in, and you can.
I just do it all at the end. That was very convenient when that used to be the way you would do all the links and everything right at the end.
Oh, well, that's
so when
true.
Someone looks at it afterwards, they don't have to filter through, you know.
But good point. You need to write it down so you don't forget.
Wasn't convenient when I was doing it. I forgot everything I said.
Yeah, I have a hard enough time typing up the description of the show after the show. But so what do we got news-wise or email-wise?
Well, there was an unusual number of weird and tragic theistic nonsense going on. And I'll just kind of
like every other week
gloss over
we do the show. Like,
yes.
So what made it unusual?
Don't tend to think that this is, you know, exceptional, but because this kind of shit is happening all the frickin' time. But suspect says God made him kill cook girlfriend.
Wait, kill his cook girlfriend?
No.
Or kill and cook his
kill
girlfriend?
Kill and cook his girlfriend. They suspect in anticipation of eating his girlfriend, which is...
Or serving
And,
her.
Of course, this is in Tyler, Texas. Texas, that great state. Everything's bigger in Texas, even the insanity. Another headline is mom charged in possessed girls' deaths.
Nice.
Funerals set for sisters found dead after magic spell.
We'll chalk that one up to Satanism, and if they'd found Jesus, then that would have never happened.
Yeah, and this one's just priceless. Man sees mark of beast, cuts off and microwaves his own hand.
Nice.
Yeah. It's
it's
been a good 2 weeks. Yeah.
It's too bad he didn't see the mark of the beast on his nether regions. We could have had a Darwin Award.
Right. But it's pretty nuts out there. But religion is harmless. It's harmless.
Yes.
Let's see. What other news do we have?
I've got a slew of creationist news, if you're interested.
Oh, yeah? Go for it.
Okay.
I've got one, too, unless you're already going to report it.
I might have.
You might already have it.
It depends. Well, one of them is the fact that, and we had some disagreement over the impact of this story before the show. You remember that movie Expelled
that
Ben Stein is starring in? Got a bunch of interviews under false pretenses with people. And I believe they are going for a theatrical release, which we were unsure about earlier when we talked about it. And not only are they going for a theatrical release, but... just to make sure that they can get their numbers up, they are paying people to go see it.
Cool. How do I get in on that?
Well, you can take the Expelled Challenge, which you can find at getexpelled.com. Mainly if you're part of a school, especially a Christian school. And again, I just have to say how much I love that they're not even trying to hide the religious angle this time around.
Right.
To engage Christian schools to get as many parents and faculty from your school out to see Ben Stein's Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed opening in April, here are some suggestions as to how to do that. Organize a school field trip and invite parents to attend as well. Offer extra credit for your students to go on your own time.
Oh, wow.
And the reward is that if you collect a whole bunch of ticket stubs, then you can get money back for each stub. $5 per ticket if you send in up to 99 ticket stubs. $1,000 donated to your school if you send in up to 300 stubs. $2,500 donated if you donate up to 500 stubs, and $5,000 if you donate up to 500 ticket stubs, over 500. So, you know, you don't have, like Martin was saying on the Atheist Experience blog, if you think that your movie is not going to get any customers, you can always artificially inflate
I really don't think that's. I don't think that's the reasoning, because this isn't a movie that is going to have financial success theatrically. It might barely make it. You know, make it. It'll make its money back on DVD, definitely.
I don't even know that it's going to make its money back. I mean, like, I've read that there's like a network of right wing authors, for instance. This is somewhat unrelated, but similar. There, very conservative books routinely make the New York Times bestseller list, even if nobody is reading them, because right. What happens is there are organizations that buy them in bulk and distribute them for free to people.
Right.
And what that does is it doesn't make a profit, but we're dealing with an organization like churches in this case, which already have a lot of money, and it's a PR move to make it look like you've got a lot. Hey, look, we have a whole bunch of people seeing this movie. It's really popular.
See, I really don't know that that's the reasoning. It's a documentary with an agenda.
Yeah.
And I think that they're doing this to get people to see the movie and to get the word out, not to increase their box office numbers. I don't think that even if they were, you know, letting people in for free, it's going to have a limited theatrical release at best, and it's not going to do very well. I don't think that they're doing it to make the movie look successful. I think they're genuinely doing it to get the word out.
And today to try to get more their cynical than across. Shilling. So this is a red letter day for me.
Somebody called Guinness. Well, it seems obvious to me that if you turn in 500 tickets and you're going to get $5,000, and that's obviously, let's see, one dude carry the 7-3, that's $10 a freaking ticket.
They're donating the money to the schools. They're not giving the money back to the people.
Right.
That's the other thing is...
it's a way for the schools to make money, because what they're suggesting is you have the students buy their own tickets, right. Take them to the cheap Saturday matinee where they're all getting in for, you know, $354 or whatever,
right.
And then turn in all those ticket stubs and collect $5,000 for the school. One of the things was they suggested they make this a mandatory field trip with the parents paying for it. And right. I was
I'm a little unclear on whether that's restricted to suggestions for Christian schools. I mean, I don't even know if they can get away with that in public schools.
Yeah, I'd be pretty uncomfortable with that in a public school. But
the way it looks like to me is they're providing. I'd sue their ass off.
Yeah. They're providing, to a certain degree, a fundraising opportunity for Christian schools. This is perfectly in line with the thinking of a lot of Christian schools. So I really don't think it's out of line for Christian schools to engage in shit like this.
And in fairness, Brian Fleming did something similar with The God Who Wasn't There, which was you can buy the DVD and your organization can arrange a screening for it and charge X amount of dollars for your own profit until you reach a certain point, and then once you reach a certain point of income, then you have to start funneling money his direction.
Okay.
So, and this wasn't a way of making bunches
particularly
of money.
With documentaries, low-budget documentaries that have so much of an agenda, I think it's really just about getting people to see it. It's not about trying to look successful, because it's not going to be.
I don't see this as sort of a maverick, low-budget, little independent film here. I see this as a piece that a religious organization was deliberately sponsoring, got the right. biggest name that they could come up with. I don't think they expect to make money at it. I think they just want it in the whole muddying the waters of what's real science today.
Right. Yeah, I don't think they're looking for money or success. I think they're honestly trying to get their message out there. And their message is horseshit. But right. they just want to get the movie seen by people. I think that is their goal, is yes. just to get it seen.
And I think they're using this "we'll pay you to take your kids to see it" kind of thing yeah. as a way of artificially making the movie look like a more important phenomenon than it actually is. That's really what I think the agenda is here.
Yeah, well, numbers will lend it weight.
Well, I will say that they've obviously managed to get some attention, even just doing something like this, a publicity stunt, people talking about it.
Right.
You know, And honestly, despite the air of mystery that J.J. Abrams and others wanted to surround Cloverfield, I think I've heard more about Expelled in the past week or two than I have about Cloverfield, and it opened yesterday.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, to spoil the surprise, I haven't seen it. Just another monster film.
Yeah. Has any atheist come out to ban the film Expelled?
Of course not.
Wow. I guess that banning things only comes from one direction, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, if it hits the draft house, I'm going to go see it.
Yeah.
Better organize an ACA trip.
Yes, absolutely.
Given enough alcohol, movie will
be
very
entertaining. I'm going to see it as soon as I can with as many atheists as I can.
Right.
I don't know. I might want to watch it at home so I can yell freely, you know.
Come on, you can yell freely. You'll be in a section with us.
I guess so. Another creationist thing here. A fossil find could lead to ruin of Crosbyton Museum owner.
This is the mastodon skull?
Yeah, yeah. Well, sorry.
That's great.
Cool.
I didn't want to hog him off.
Apparently, Joe Tyler runs a creationist museum in Taylor, Texas. The Mount Blanco Fossil Museum was part of a group who unearthed a Allosaurus skull or Allosaurus fossil, which had a perfectly intact head, and they go great, but unfortunately another creationist wanted to share in the discovery, and so there ensued a court battle. And apparently, reading this little article, part of the court battle was part of the agreement called a non-disparagement clause, stated neither side could talk badly about the other anymore. And that's where Taylor dug himself into a hole, a $130,000 hole. And so at $5,000 per disparaging comment, Taylor's crusade to clear his name cost him $100,000 plus $29,399 in legal fees he has to fork over to the claimant, costing him more than he made on the Allosaurus find. And so, to make up the shortfall, he's putting up one of his prized possessions, this mastodon skull. And so, this is a case of creationists eating their own, which is kind of amusing.
I always enjoy that.
Creationist's bat. Very cool. But one person brought up... Now, I don't know if they're advertising it on the on eBay or whatever as being, this mastodon skull is, 40,000 years old. But we're going, wait, 40,000 years old? Isn't it only 6?
Yeah. I thought it couldn't be more than 6 to 10,000 years old.
Yeah, that's it, max, man. So it wasn't during the last ice age, because the last ice age happened before the Earth was formed. So that can't be true.
And dogs were domesticated before the Earth was formed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, I mean, I think the odd...
And that was wrong, by the way.
The odd thing is, let's see, it looks like they've put it up on the Heritage Auction Galleries. Basically, the art item description says that it's 40,000 years old.
Oh, that's awesome. That is freaking awesome.
Although, do we know for sure that his was a young Earth creationist museum?
Well,
I'm going to assume that a creationism museum in Texas, I think it's a pretty safe bet.
Taylor and other creationists say the Allosaurus and other dinosaurs lived on Earth several thousand years ago and were wiped out by a worldwide flood survived by Noah.
Yeah.
The museum features a display on Noah and his ark.
This is about making money.
Right.
And when it comes to making money, you can get more if you say that it's 40,000
years old. Yeah, but he's lying one way or the other. He's lying. Wow.
Arguably, if he's making the claim that it's 40,000, if you're using an auction house, you might have them do the appraisal and the description. So that way he
Yeah, he's just selling it, and they're the ones who say
that it's letting them handle.
He's absolving himself of responsibility for the falsehood in the description. Yeah,
it's like if I created a brilliant forgery of the Mona Lisa. I'm not actually claiming it's real, but if I can convince some auction house to do it, and they sell it, I'll take the money.
Yeah. No. I'm not cutting this guy any slack.
Let's see. And there is one last creationism story.
Oh, cool.
Right here in Texas.
Another one in Texas.
Man, yeah. Texas is like a hotbed of idiocy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we'll no kidding. And speaking of, well, we'll get to that. Questions delay creationist master's degree.
Oh, no, yes, that.
Scientists fearful that Texas was about to approve a program to offer online master's degrees in science education from a creationist perspective received some good news on Tuesday. The Institute for Creation Research, which received preliminary approval last month from an advisory committee to the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, asked the commission not to consider the matter at this month's meeting.
Yeah, we actually talked about this briefly on last week's show before this announcement came out, because I had been alerted to this and sent an email to the person heading up the committee that was going to make the recommendation to the board. They've never written back.
Okay.
And this past Wednesday, several of us, including Sandra Schilling and I, went to a meeting put on by CFI that was hosted by CFI, but run by the Texas Citizens for Science, that discussed this issue and the recent riding out on a rail, essentially, or forced firing of Chris Comer.
Yeah. Well, it does mention you obliquely in a general sense.
Really?
It says Raymond A. Paredes, Commissioner of Higher Education for Texas, said he has received numerous email messages from politicians. Oh, never mind. That's not you.
I was going to say, where am I at?
And others offering advice on handling the Institute.
You're under the category of others.
But I didn't email him. I emailed he's on the board, and I emailed the committee that was doing the board. And really, it was a really simple email. I basically said, I'm not familiar with the way your organization works and processes this stuff. I'm curious as to what your recommendation is going to be to the board and what effect this has on accreditation for that.
Right, because when we heard about it, someone had sent us the minutes from the meeting.
Yeah.
And they were a little on the vague side if you're not used to reading the minutes of those types of meetings, so it was kind of hard to figure out how exactly they were handling it.
They've changed the name of what they're doing a couple times, and at one point I had no problem. You want to offer a master's degree in creation studies? Okay. You can offer a master's degree in divinity or theology or anything
flat
else.
Flat earthism? Oh, yeah. Sure. Go ahead.
Because, well, you know, everybody's going to look at that and say, you got a master's in creationism?
Yeah, but I think that this is an overall, this is one step in part of an overall trend of basically trying to put yourself on the same footing with serious pursuits of knowledge, so that you can then turn around and say that there is no difference between different types of pursuits of knowledge. I mean, if you can have a master's degree program in creation science, and it's accredited by the state, then effectively some guy who has a master's degree from the University of Texas biology department has no more claim than you for being credible in the eyes of laymen.
Right, they got the same letters.
Both have a master's degree, and it's accredited by the University of Texas.
Yeah, they got the same little letters in front of their name.
Right, it's the same principle as the same organization, the Institute for Creation Research, seeing that people made fun of intelligent design because, you know, they almost never get any articles published in peer-reviewed papers, say, all right, we're going to set up our own peer-reviewed papers.
Here's the thing, though.
We're going to set up our own journals where any creationist can publish their own papers. And then they'll be published.
They'll be peer-reviewed.
Here's the thing. This is where I disagree.
Yeah.
ICR doesn't want to have a master's degree in creation studies, which is why they've tried so desperately to name this thing as if it's a real science degree.
Yeah.
I have no problem, even with the University of Texas, although I'd prefer that they didn't, but I understand that this could be legitimate to offer a master's in divinity, a master's in theology, and a master's in creation studies. It doesn't matter to me that two graduates from the same accredited school have the same letters after their name. They're both recognized authorities in something. But when we're talking about the scientific explanation for life, the universe, and everything, the one with the master's degree in biology is the one with the degree that's relevant to what we're discussing, and the one in the master's with the master's in divinity or creation studies isn't.
Yeah, but does the general public get that?
It's irrelevant whether or not the general public gets it.
No, it's very relevant.
I mean, who wins the public discourse?
There are so many things you can get a master's degree in, though. It goes to how much leeway a school has in what they're going to offer and how far you can go with that. Now, if they wanted to put creation studies under the College of Science, that'd be a problem. But just to offer a master's in that, I don't see any more problem than offering a master's in specific philosophies.
There's nothing to guarantee that somebody who gets a master's in evolutionary biology isn't going to use that as a young Earth creationist, as we've already seen.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, if somebody gets like the University of Texas, for example, has a certain reputation. And if somebody comes through having a master's degree in biology from the University of Texas, at least you know that person, dumb creationist though he might be, he was at least smart enough to get through and pass a whole bunch of classes.
Right. But how is that relevant? If what they're advocating is in opposition, then they're no different from somebody who got their diploma from a creationist diploma.
Yeah, but they actually have to do work that way.
No.
This creationist thing, they could just do shit.
They had
Who fucking cares?
They had to pass the tests and do this stuff, but if that's not what they're advocating, I mean, how's that different? Whether
it's a limit to the number of people who are going to be willing to do that,
right? I think it's a winnowing process. It's never going to be 100%, but I think you can safely say that if you have to do a bunch of studying and pass a bunch of tests in order to actually get that degree over a certain number of years,
that keeps the numbers down.
Fewer people who were just going, yeah. I want to give.
But as soon as you get creationist studies in there, Joe Schmo can
not necessarily.
I think a creationist studies
degree could be extremely rigorous. It's based on horseshit. That doesn't mean that you can't arrange some level of work. It could be you would have to know a lot about the history of creationism. Things along those lines.
Right,
except
past experience shows that doesn't really happen.
No.
I mean,
it doesn't happen with the diploma
mills. Kent Hovind's so-called, I think, master's thesis or PhD thesis or something is actually on the interwebs somewhere.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. And that goes
and
that goes to
really
the place
stupid.
It's doing it.
It's going to be like a diploma mill.
Right.
Except it's going to have the name University of Texas.
No, see, that's the whole point. That's the whole point. That's not going to be the case. In order for them to receive accreditation, they're going to have to meet rigorous standards to show that their degree meets the expectations of that university and of that system. That's the reason why they go to the diploma mills in the first place. That's the reason why Institute for Creation Research is trying to do this end around. Because what they're getting is not accreditation. They're getting the approval to grant master's degree as post-secondary education, and it lasts for 2 years, and they can renew it in perpetuity. But it's not accreditation. What they're getting is not accreditation. And I have no – when I say I have no problem with it, I'd prefer that we spend our time studying things that were real.
Yeah.
But you could make – at UNT, for example, there's a new religious studies department that may actually become a department in the near future. And – I'm actually in favor of that. And somebody who's got, for example, a master's degree in a particular style of, whether it be biblical literacy, whether it be or biblical criticism, I guess would be better, religious history, you could become a certified expert in creation studies in that you would be fully versed and knowledgeable about the creation stories from a variety of different religions. But the thing is that when we go out to determine who should we trust when we're having this conversation, Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project, eminent scientist, really crazy ideas when it comes to the existence of a God. If you're convinced by a waterfall, you've chucked everything else out the window. But he's got a degree. He's got excellent credentials. And he's a good scientist in the sense that, you know, one of the quotes from him that I use most often is that even the absence of a fossil record confirmation, DNA evidence alone is enough to confirm common ancestry.
Yeah.
Well, okay, great. So he's completely separated. He's not a creationist in any sense that we talk about. But when you have two people, let's say they're both from UT, they both have similar credentials, but they're in different areas.
Right.
That's when you have to determine whether or not what they are qualified experts in what we're actually talking about.
The onus is going to be on people who compare the two to see that if you're talking about something biological or regarding evolution, the person with the master's in biology has good footing. The person with masters in creation science or ceramics have equally bad footing.
But
not
I mean,
all masters are necessarily
I mean,
equal.
I mean, just to be pedantic here, I don't think, I mean, funny use of language aside, I don't think the University of Texas actually offers a master's degree in ceramics. And,
but there are
plenty of schools
that do.
A
master's in some liberal art, it doesn't matter what it is, but something wholly irrelevant to science, they certainly offer that. And while it does indicate a certain art history, it does indicate a certain level of education, it doesn't indicate relevant education.
But I'm saying that you can't get approval in just anything to say that you have a master's degree for the most part.
Right.
And Texas, I mean, you know, to the extent that Texas has any academic credibility anyway, and I shouldn't say that because, you know, I just finished at UT, and they have an excellent reputation as a school.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Texas does have a certain reputation for academic excellence in some areas, and they're taking their reputation and throwing it around and just marking a stamp of approval on this thing.
Well, it's,
no.
And I think there's no point to that.
That's what they're trying. There are some people trying to get this in.
Yeah,
I don't think this will ever be accredited.
I think what we're saying is the problem isn't with there being a master's degree in creationism. The problem is with the way this institute is going to go about it. You could, in theory, create a good master's degree in creation science. It wouldn't give you any credibility for actual science, but an actual university could make a master's degree in that, and that would be fine. The problem is with this particular institute doing it.
I think all this ends up kind of being sidelined because I agree with the speaker we listened to on Wednesday and some other people. I don't think there's any way this will ever receive accreditation. But what it may do is it may sit there renewing this approval in perpetuity so that they operate at a confusingly similar level. And you know, they've been denied elsewhere. And I think that what we need are people who actually care about the quality of scientific education in Texas to get up and write letters and email the heads of THECB, which is the Texas Higher Education Commission Board. I forget what the last bit is. They're the ones who make recommendations to the state legislature about which programs should or shouldn't be allowed to be, you know, accredited institutions.
Right. I'm depressed lately.
Me too.
Let me make this personal for a second, because I am so irritated with having to fight these battles over and over again, or at least, I mean, fight them, what's the word? I'm not really fighting them, but I'm watching other people fight them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just arguing about them a lot on the internet. But, I mean, the point is, there shouldn't be much of an argument about Texas granting this kind of authority to the Institute for Creation Research. I mean, you can say, oh, let's let's have these arguments and have them stand on their own merits. But, I mean, these arguments have been had.
Right.
And it's like Groundhog Day, where you wake up every day and it's like, you know, then the same waitress is going to drop her dishes again that she dropped yesterday.
I know the
Bill Murray movie, not the holiday. You know, nobody doesn't know.
I know the odometer kicked over 3 zeros 8 years ago, right? But I'm still waiting to enter the 21st century. It's really annoying. Well,
the thing we went to Wednesday, they handed out a little pamphlet with the title of whatever the event was called. And it was something along the lines of, will Texas teach 21st century science? And when we're talking about evolution, the question is, will Texas teach fucking 20th century
science?
No,
that's 19th century
science. Yeah, it goes pretty far back.
Yeah.
Yeah, will Texas support 21st century science education? A briefing by Texas Citizens for Science. Stephen Schaferman is the president there, and one of the speakers, Chris Comer, was also there, although she can't talk about her situation. Stephen talked about it for her, I guess.
On the good.
And Martin wrote up a fantastic report on the Atheist Experience blog.
Yeah, Martin was sitting right there next to me. There was lots of good stuff there. There are big concerns over the Texas School Board, things that we may not be able to solve with elections, if I'm understanding the speakers correctly. And what we're going to have to do, and the science standards are up for review, and things could be changing as early as November.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, one of the things that I made a kind of a quick joke, the Texas Freedom Network was there, and they have evidently a portion of their newsletter that's called the State of the Religious Right. And I said that my only goal was to make sure that the State of the Religious Right wasn't Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to be Kansas. I don't want to have to do the fight that Kansas that they did in Kansas or in Pennsylvania or Ohio or any other place where they've done this. Because, like Russell's saying, it's like Groundhog Day. We've done this all before.
Right.
I mean, the ACA was instrumental in the Texas school book hearings a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yep.
And making sure that changes. You know, I think science books need to be changed because guess what? Our understanding is constantly changing.
Right.
But to this and kind of redactive.
I mean, we won in 2003.
Yeah.
But the problem is.
They never shut up.
You know, the.
It's basically the same shit, slightly different tint.
Yeah,
they're
but
taking
not
it
only
at
same
semantically
shit, different.
Different
tint. But if I'm understanding what I read in Martin's post, basically what they're going to do is just wait for people to elect more stupid, clueless creationists and eventually have such overwhelming numbers on the board that it gets rammed through regardless of what any people think.
Yeah, that's one tactic, but then the
and
other one
is
just...
why aren't you dumbasses voting? Hello. Well, which I mean dumbasses who agree with me.
Yeah. you know, they put,
but don't vote.
They put Don McElroy in there, and they've changed the makeup of some of the board. They've got, you know, Chris Comer and some other people have been fired or left or resigned or for whatever reason. And if the reports that I'm hearing are accurate, what we're looking at is a school board that's where 7 out of the 15 members are creationists, some of them young earth creationists. All of those 7 were advocating the essentially elimination of teaching evolution in public schools.
Right. And that doesn't
affect Texas, that
affects the entire country because our textbooks get propagated to everybody else.
Kind of.
Let's hope that changes.
As somebody who just recently worked for one of the major manufacturers of public schools textbooks, they do produce special versions for Texas and California and North Carolina and in different areas, and it's all based on the different state standards of, you know, that exist. Texas,
retarded
Texas is an adoptionist state, which means the school board gets together and decides what books go to all the schools, and then the schools just request the books. Individual schools don't get to pick their books. And because of that, they kind of drive the textbook industry, and therefore our books get spread out to more places.
Right.
But the main thing Wednesday, it was an interesting meeting, but there wasn't a lot of information available on what we should be doing. Yeah. They're still, you know, sort of trying to figure that out. But one of the main things they brought up was this was exactly what they're trying to do with evolution is teach the weaknesses. And that's the phrasing is teach evolution, but also teach the weaknesses.
Right, which is more or less the same thing they were saying in 2003.
Right, but it's just semantically a little different enough that we have to fight it again.
Right.
And their list of weaknesses is
well, they
is
were
pretty
saying
pathetic.
Exactly those things in 2003. I mean, they even back then there were a lot of people who went in thinking that they were trying to get intelligent design into the textbook when it was really just the same thing, which was Jonathan Wells's Icons of Evolution. It has this list of things that are wrong with evolution, and a lot of them are themselves wrong or misleading in some way. And in fact, I went into the school board hearings with a rebuttal prepared to one of Jonathan Wells' points, where he flat out lied and misrepresented the work of some other scientist, said, you know, oh, this scientist's work says that moths never rest on trees, and so we can't use those pictures of the black moth and the white moth anymore. And that guy in particular wrote to him, and he says, you totally didn't understand my work because I included a bunch of documentation of moths resting on trees. So, I mean, this Jonathan Wells guy is full of bullshit. And the strategy is apparently just to sit there and poke holes in evolution, which in a way is really not that much different from what the young Earth creationists have been doing for 100 years.
Right.
They just are trying to get more and more subtle about it.
But the way they're packaging it sounds great. That's the big problem is, oh, teach the weaknesses. That sounds great of any science. You should teach the weaknesses of any science, the areas where we're still working on things. But the list of weaknesses they have is piss poor. They're not actual weaknesses.
Yes, and by the way, let's promote this, you know, of pandas and people book.
Yeah.
By giving it a nod at the back of the textbook. If you want to explore more about the weaknesses of evolution, may we recommend this fine book?
Right.
Ugh. Yeah, the weaknesses of evolution or any theory are really representative of what we don't yet know or what we're working on or anything that represents an incomplete explanation. But the kind of an example I came up with the other night, and you'll have to use your imagination for this because I think people respond pretty well to graphs. But it's hard to describe a graph really well. So imagine
Franken used to use a slide whistle.
Imagine that this is a bar graph, and the first column is essentially the magnitude, the number, the amount of evidence favoring evolution, the explanatory power of evolutionary theory, its strengths. And if that were, let's say, and I'm just blatantly making shit up right now, but if it were like 3 inches high on the graph, then next to it, and maybe this little eighth inch high column are the weaknesses of evolution. And once we exclude the idea of things we don't know, you know, absolutely. But questions that are kind of tangential to the theory that would say, it doesn't really explain this, even if it wasn't designed to. Then if you zoom in on that little eighth inch section and make it the 3 inch tall section, about an eighth of an inch of that is actually the strengths of creationism.
Right.
So creationism's strengths are to evolution's weaknesses as evolution's weaknesses are to evolution's strengths.
See, I still don't know if I agree with that. I don't know that creationism now, ever has any strength whatsoever.
Is one of the
I'm willing to accept that it's an empty set, that the column is flat,
okay,
and it's zero. I'm just saying that, you know,
because I've never heard a creationist argument in my fucking life. I've heard their arguments against evolution. That's it.
That's it.
And this presumption of complexity, which is ridiculous.
I had a guy come in on the on the Evolution versus Creation board on Fool.com, where I hang out. And he was a new guy, and he just comes in and says, hey, I want to learn more about the evolution-creation debate. Can somebody recommend a good book to me that that shows the evidence for creation? And a whole bunch of us evolution people spoke up saying, you know, blah, 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 there isn't any. And he's like, now, fellas, stop trying to intimidate the creationists. And then one guy comes in and he says, if you want to see a response to the lies that evolutionists are spinning, you should look at this and also the Bible.
Well, what you should have done is give him a little URL link of about colon blank.
Right.
Yeah.
That is the source of all creation arguments.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, what it came down to was even the guy who was purporting to answer the question didn't do anything but say, here's my answer to evolution and why that couldn't be true.
Right.
And he mentioned the Bible.
And still nothing in favor of creationism.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, the new atheists have kind of come under fire. I was reading an article this morning before the show of somebody who was saying, essentially, you know, Dawkins, Dennett, Hitchens, Harris, Stinger, all these people are writing these anti-God books, which are really just anti-religion, and yet they're offering us nothing at all to compensate for the real issues, the real things that religion does, which offers answers and hopes with regard to our existence and purpose. Atheism tells us nothing at all about our purpose. And immediately it just jumped right to the forefront of this whole issue of asking the wrong questions. Oh, well, of course atheism doesn't tell you anything about your ultimate purpose, and religion does, because the whole reason you think there is an ultimate purpose is because religion has been spoon-feeding you this answer that you accept. Chuck it out and say, is there actually an ultimate in purpose? I realize that it's uncomfortable for people, especially coming from a religious background, to conceive of the idea that there may not be any purpose in the sense that they've traditionally accepted it. But unfortunately for you guys, that may in fact be the case, and I happen to think that it is. The kind of purpose that you're anticipating and that you're using religion to provide is an entirely fictional construct of religion. It's born of our fears of, you know, loneliness or death or whatever else.
Right. I mean, that argument just smacks of, you know, please make my life meaningful for me.
Yeah.
No, that's not my job. Make your own damn life meaningful. Do something. Yes.
I would take a minor exception that I don't think you disagree with. I don't think that it comes from religion. I think that it's in large part what religion comes from.
Okay.
A presumptuous.
That's fair enough.
Presumptuous sense that there's.
I think that was the case originally.
Yeah, like a one.
And now I think that what we're seeing is religions being created specifically to answer
right.
that.
And the reason that people can't even conceive of purposeless existence is because of religion.
Yes.
But, I mean, it reminds me, just this week, somebody forwarded me an essay on cracked.com, which I always considered Cracked to be an inferior version of Mad Magazine, but actually their website is really funny, and they've been writing a lot of insightful blog posts lately.
Really?
Yeah, you should check it out sometime.
I'll have to do that.
And this guy was writing about why people are unhappy these days when they have so much stuff.
And, yeah.
And brilliant. He, you know, part of it, he said, was basically that we, well, there was a lot to it. But,
right.
I mean, basically, one of the things he said is that we've grown to expect. I mean, we have so many things that give us instant gratification that, you know, we feel like we deserve to be happy even when we're not actually doing anything about it.
Yeah.
you know, even when we're not doing anything meaningful, we think that we should be made to feel good. Just because we're entitled to it.
Huh. Yeah, there's a certain amount of entitlement
and
there.
I think religion fits right into that with the whole, you know, it's faith, not works. You don't have to do anything.
Right.
You just have to believe the right thing and suddenly...
To be fair, not all religions are faith, not works.
And, okay. I mean, my personal hedonism buys into that pretty well.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not I'm doing something, I have a sense of entitlement to be pleased.
Right.
And I seek to accommodate that however I can.
I'm a hedonist too, but I mean the way I apply that is basically Bertrand Russell wrote something called The Conquest of Happiness.
Right.
Which I think is a great motto to have, which is if you're not happy, then figure out what you need to do to be happy and damn well do it.
Oh,
right.
That sucks, but because that means I have to make all my friends happy.
But the entitlement to happiness.
You make
though,
me happy, Dennis.
That's
I think that's, to a large degree, a good thing because it can be a driving factor to make yourself happy and not just accept, oh, well, I'm unhappy now, but when I'm up in heaven as one of Jesus's pets, everything will be okay.
Right.
If you take a more mortal view of, well, when I'm dead, that's it, you kind of tend to make the most of your time. And if you're unhappy, you're more likely to want to change that soon rather than just pray and wait.
Yeah. Well, it can be a driving factor, or it can also make you think something like, oh, I'm entitled to be happy, so how come I'm not? Oh, my life is miserable.
Yeah.
I can't get up off this couch.
Another thing that I read this morning that I'll kind of toss out there, I don't know that this will cause any good conversation or... I doubt there's much disagreement, but I found it interesting. A Unitarian Universalist church in Massachusetts announced their sermon that they're having tomorrow. And somehow or another, this one of Google's spiders picked it up and threw it in my news on atheism, because the reverend's going to get up and talk about how the humanist perspective, which many UU folks have, is very different from the fundamentalist atheists that we're so commonly seeing in the
news.
That's exactly what I said. Now, I spent last Sunday at the First Unitarian Universalist Church here in Austin listening to a lecture by Michael Dowd, who describes himself as an evolutionary Christian. He is a huge proponent of evolution. I may talk more about that later. I told him afterwards when we talked for a few minutes that within 3 minutes of him speaking, I had written down in my notebook, he sounds like an atheist who's enamored of religious language as a metaphor for reality. Yeah. And I think that that's accurate. His wife's an atheist and a humanist. He identifies himself as a Christian. But from any practical perspective of what it is he believes and what he's advocating, he's an atheist in my book still.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mind if he, you know, calls himself a Christian. I just don't think that's the best choice. Kind of like when, LaVey and Satanist adopted Satanism and then complain when somebody misunderstands what the hell they're talking about. But anyway, the response to this announcement of a sermon, it was, you know, where you could actually post comments on the sermon, and it brought a few comments. One of the early ones I liked. We've been called dogmatists. Let's consider caveman number one seeing a flash of light and hearing the thunder saying to the other caveman, we must appease the gods. Caveman number two answers, after considering his experience of what happens after thunder and lightning, I think we ought to take shelter. We're going to get wet. This is a metaphor. This is metaphorical of how the first theist and the first atheist responded to natural events in the world we share. She goes on to make some other points. I like what she said. I think she may have made one little mistake in that one of the cavemen is specifically addressing what is the cause or reason for this, and the other caveman is simply addressing what do we do about it.
Yeah, the practical response.
Now, I think that may in fact be a good example of why theists and atheists have so much problem communicating. Because from the theist perspective, there's a number of different answers you could come up with. One being the rain, the thunder and lightning represents the anger or disappointment of the gods, and we must therefore do something to appease them, whether it be the sacrifice of a virgin or a non-believer or a goat, or even just praying. that these are all viable actions to take based on your belief that this is caused by a being who is angry or upset. There's another theistic belief which would say this is caused by God and exists to challenge us in some way. And that sort of belief, which we often identify as, you know, more moderate beliefs, can actually focus on what kind of action we should take. Similarly, there may be the claim that this isn't a test from God, but it's actually a blessing from God. The rain makes the crops grow, and therefore there's nothing to worry about at all.
Right.
Meanwhile, you've still got this person over the side who is saying the situation practically and saying, hello, you're all wet. You're all out there getting wet. Come over here, you know, get out of there. It doesn't matter whether this is caused by a God or his anger or his attempt to teach us or try us. Come over here where it's dry. And the people out there who are saying, no, we need to sacrifice this goat or we need to pray, they've taken a completely unreasonable approach to resolving this. And the second you point it out and say, you are necessarily saying that their approach is wrong because their initial assumption is wrong, or that you don't agree with their initial assumption. Whether you're an agnostic, atheist, secular, humanist, this idea that there's some fundamentalist atheism out there, as if some dogma exists, or as if we've just decided we don't want to believe in God and therefore we're going to shun everything that's done in his name, is absurd. I don't see that from anybody, not Dawkins, Dennett, Hitchens, Harris, anybody. None of the people on this show, and yet I know that those are the people, and we are probably the people, that this minister is probably talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what we're really saying is that you are a fundamentalist if you're vocally opposing somebody else's beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Well,
regardless of the action taken.
Mm-hmm. That's not I'd have the to double, definition of that I understand.
Yeah,
I'd have to double check it, but I'm in a gray area on exactly what determines a fundamentalist of a viewpoint.
Well, I don't see how you can have a fundamentalist without some sort of dogma. I mean, to me, those things go hand in hand.
Right. I mean, religious people frequently talk about atheists regarding one book or another, like the Atheist Bible, you know. They're following their Pope, Richard Dawkins, and they're reading their Bible, The Origin of the Species.
Yeah.
But we don't treat any of our books like they treat the Bible. Right. I mean, you know, I don't just read one book. In fact, I haven't even read most of The Origin of the Species, and I understand it's influential, but it's 150 years old. I mean, there's newer and better written stuff now.
And that doesn't intrinsically have anything to do with atheism. I mean, I don't believe you is not a dogma.
Right.
The thing is, and it's hard to draw this distinction, but I think it's critical into why there's so much problem communicating and also in understanding the opposition, because they're viewed as opposition. And that is, it's really about what the basis for making your decision is. And, for example, while I don't have a good definition, a fundamentalist theist is making decisions based on a dogmatic assumption that their God actually exists. The decision is directly comes from their belief that a God exists.
Well, sure. Christians, an atheist, who are not fundamentalists, also do that.
I understand, but I'm just trying to get down this fundamentalist idea.
Okay.
An atheist doesn't make decisions based on a belief that a God doesn't exist.
Right.
The core footing or foundation for the beliefs is reason and evidence. We're going to make decisions based on reason and evidence. And where reason and evidence are lacking, we are not going to make any. We can't base anything on that.
Right.
Well,
you could.
I don't agree that all atheists have to use reason and evidence.
No.
No.
You can be an atheist for silly reasons.
You can be a fundamentalist atheist
if
you're in one of the atheistic religions. You could certainly be.
Yeah, but
I don't know if you'd be fundamentalist
in principle,
atheist.
But
there,
I don't
though.
Think there are any. I mean, when I try to think of a general definition of fundamentalists that applies to any religious fundamentalist, what I think of is they take one particular source and they treat it as not open to questioning.
They
treat that as the ultimate source, unchanging and always right. And I think part of the issue with the scientific worldview that Christians in general have a hard time understanding is that there is no such thing as that.
Could one be, a fundamentalist materialist?
Question everything.
What is the source from which they draw their fundamentalism?
I don't necessarily agree that you would need to have a source. If you're basing everything off of this one idea,
that means foundational, not necessarily. Okay.
Materialism is a foundation for my atheism. I've been known to describe some people as Ayn Rand fundamentalists.
Yeah.
And I think that's a justified use of the words. Not for everybody who likes Ayn Rand's books, but for certain people who take it so seriously that Ayn Rand, in some kind of creepy way, is just
when they get to the point where what Ayn Rand says cannot be questioned,
right?
When they get to that point, they're a fundamentalist.
I've never met one of those.
I have.
Okay.
I mean, they're out there.
One of them actually came in and started arguing at the atheist group before you were in. Yeah. At breakfast one morning, they come in and he starts talking about how great Ayn Rand's ideas are, and somebody said, you talk about Ayn Rand kind of the way some people talk about God, and the guy really said something like, well, she was very godlike in her brilliance. Wow. And I think when you get to that point...
Well, that something like that, it could be because she's Ayn Rand, but it could be because they do happen to agree with every single thing that she says. And that's entirely possible. I've not read even most of his work, but I've yet to read something from Bertrand Russell that I disagree with.
I probably have.
I might at some point, but at least for now, I agree with everything.
Well, maybe that's enough. Maybe the acknowledgement that you're free to disagree with him at any point where your views, apart from their views, your views have priority. Right. And in the fundamentalist scheme, wherever your views, apart from the God's views, the author's views, the authoritarian view, you're the one that's wrong. You're the one that's a sinner.
Or at least, depending on what kind of fundamentalist you are, you have to make some kind of linguistic justification why your holy source doesn't really say what it says, but actually says something you agree with.
Yeah.
When it said we should stone homosexuals to death, that was just figurative, or, that was just for those particular people in that time.
Yeah, so in that respect, I really agree with what Matt just said, but I don't think that in practice that's how it works at all. I think that they do prioritize what they want to believe, and they just try to mold it into supporting that. But I do think, in theory, it is... when they're in conflict, they're the ones who are wrong. They just try to arrange a way around that conflict.
Yeah, I think there's a way that if you're a fundamentalist, the argument from authority is valid. I mean, I would never say anything along the lines of, I believe that evolution is right because Richard Dawkins says so.
Right.
Yeah, it's... Yep.
Mm-hmm. Neither would we dare to say that everything Richard Dawkins says is correct. Silly.
Damn close.
It's close. Some people are closer than others. Yeah, definitely.
And oddly enough, the only places... oddly enough, the only places where he's wrong are where he disagrees with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Coincidence. It's just a coincidence.
One of the things is... I've forgotten already. We got like 7 minutes, and I don't think we've touched Dennis's stack of paper.
Oh, well, it's mostly...
we did start a little late.
There's some reader mail and such like that. I've got a few things I want to talk about here.
Go for it.
I like the more philosophic arguments here. So, Matthew writes... He says they on their campus, they get a preacher, Brother Jed Smock.
Yeah.
And stuff. They come there and preach all those. Yeah. Talking about original sin, omniscience, and free will, Jed said that God did not know that Adam and Eve would sin and that God doesn't know the specifics of the future. After I left, he apparently said God is omniscient but only knows the general course of human events. This struck me as a strange thing and contradictory thing to say, because surely Adam and Eve's sin would dictate the whole of human history if it weren't all make-believe. Which means that his statement that he doesn't know the specifics of the future, just the general trend, is, well, that would be the general trend. That yeah. Adam and Eve had to have failed
yeah,
right.
to the
make
argument
the
is,
general trend of human history.
The question is God omniscient? Does he know everything about the future? And the apologists, and Jed isn't alone. Some of the apologists tried to get away with this by saying that God doesn't know the specific details, but he has a general idea looking forward. Well, number one, you can't make prophetic predictions.
Yeah.
And expect them to be accurate to the degree that the religionists believe they are.
All the prophecies are, yeah.
And number two, if you create people, you can't pretend to know whether or to not know whether or not they're going to take a sinful action if you can see that the general trend of humanity down the line is in contradiction to what you're
dictated
your
by
goals.
The fact that they did the sin. Yeah. This one I got from just the Usenet. I think somebody brought up an interesting point. Adam and Eve, in the first creation story, Adam and Eve were created at the same time, right? And in the second one, Adam's created, names all the animals, does all this stuff, and I think even God decides that everything he's built is good and does his rest, and then creates Eve. Whoa. Is that the case?
Biblical criticists have been pointing out forever that the account in Genesis 1 and the account in Genesis 2 are two contradictory creation stories where things are created in a different order.
Uh-huh.
On one level, I agree with them. They're right. On another level, the apologists have said that, no, one is the account and one is a more detailed version of the account. And that the specifics don't actually matter.
Uh-huh.
I actually agree with them to some degree as well. It's an oversimplification, I think, and this is just my opinion,
sure.
to say that those two are two contradicting accounts that demonstrate that this couldn't possibly be true. Well, I agree, it's not true. It couldn't possibly be true.
Right.
But to think that for, I don't know, 3,000 years, those first two pages of every holy book have sat there in dire contradiction and no theologist noticed this beforehand is absurd. And what you have to do is recognize that the people read it with an understanding that one was an account that clarified the other. What they didn't really notice was that...
My understanding of it is that it's actually from two different oral traditions and they just jammed them in there together.
That very well would, that may be how they came together.
Right.
But they existed together from that time on with people adapting the understanding to what their understanding already was.
Well, I don't know.
Right, but that's just.
It's been a while since I've read the two, but I could see that being an argument if they weren't. If one had more explanatory power, which it doesn't really seem to, it doesn't look like the second chapter of Genesis is going more. That much more in depth on the same thing. It looks like just a different explanation of the same event.
Yeah,
it doesn't look like it's going into more depth. It doesn't look like it's taking a different angle on the story, on the same story, or anything like that.
Which is like it's starting over,
just a different story.
It's why I'm not opposed to the people who say that they're in contradiction and it represents. The thing is that when I look at the creation story, I see so many other things,
right,
that are clear. Objections to this entire construct, that whether or not you've got two different tellings of a story that are slightly different,
right.
don't really faze.
Right.
Also, can I just say something completely random and off topic about Genesis and the Adam and Eve story?
Well, then it's not completely random and off topic.
Well, the, I mean, it just seems, the story seems weird to me, like God didn't really understand what he was creating with man. I mean, because consider the whole thing from God's point of view. He's like, okay, I'm creating a man, and I'm creating him with all these sexual organs and stuff, and this brain that desires companionship, and I'm done. And man says, hey, God, I'd really like a companion. Minute. And God says, well, Adam, I gave you all these animals.
Yeah, he does. I mean, that's the story. He marches all the animals by for Adam to name, right. But among all of them, he couldn't find a helpmeet.
Right.
And you know, religionists use that soft language, but in reality, what you're saying is, uh-huh. Hey, he didn't want to fuck the monkey. So, I got it. Let's put him to sleep. We'll rip out a rib, and I can't tell you how many people I've run across, and
who still believe that we're missing a rib.
Think that there's a difference in the number of ribs between men and women.
Grief.
And you know, despite the fact that all you have to do. Assuming you're a guy and can find a woman, is just run your finger down each of you and count the fucking ribs. You don't need to do an X-ray.
Right.
You don't need...
Well, you need a slightly better relationship than just finding a woman.
Yes.
Please
do not take what we've said on the show and go out on the subway and molest somebody. You know. What do you mean that's not your rib?
One, two, three.
I only count two ribs.
Is that your rib? You're just happy to see me.
Yes. But and there's lots of things like that. There are plenty of things throughout history that fall into the category of things everybody knows. And so often they turn out to be completely wrong.
Right.
Everybody knows it, but it ain't true. Everybody knew the earth was flat. Everybody knew the sun went around the earth. They're not true.
Now, Randy writes and gives us a little...
Ooh, pause. A little
good story. Oh, go for it. What?
Because you said Randy, and I have been...
Oh...
I've been terrible about keeping up with the Swift Report. Evidently, the JREF is going to cease the Million Dollar Challenge.
I heard that.
What?
I have not read all the details. I'll look at it later. Somebody sent me a quick thing. But if, over the process of the next 2 years, in order to get through whatever applicants, I think they're going to finish this off. They've been doing it for, you know... 10 years or how long, they see, I don't know, all of his reasons are available there. But the thing that got to me, and I'd rather that the challenge continued,
but I
understand, you know, there may be good reasons for this decision. But of course, within days, these nut jobs who think that they stood a chance of winning the $1 million challenge are sending out mass emails and posting on forums saying, ha-ha, we've exposed it all as a fraud. Because one of the things Randy did was he included in there that the intent of the challenge was to serve as an arguing point for skeptics and critics to say, look, here's this challenge that no one's been able to win.
And I've used it a lot.
And I have too.
Yeah.
And these people are now respinning that. As if it's an admission that the challenge was a fraud the entire time. No. It was a real challenge, and they really tested people, and none of you dumbasses could pass.
Right.
That doesn't make it a fraud. The failure to meet the requirements of the challenge does not make it a fraud. The fact that the challenge was used as a foundation for skeptical arguments about the inefficacy of all these various claims does not make it a fraud. So they're saying, and by the way, one of the stupidest arguments was, why does it take 2 years to shut down a challenge that was a fraud from the beginning? And I just, at that point, it was like, I'm deleting your email. You're not worth having a conversation with.
Yeah.
But anyway.
But Randy writes on a positive note.
This is a different Randy.
Yes.
Amazing.
He's apparently in Utah. And so he writes, fortunately, us heathens are making some headway. Salt Lake City County, which used to be the Mecca of the Mormons, is now nearly 50% non-Mormon. The church is losing about 100,000 people a year to formal resignations.
Well,
I hope he's right.
I'm optimistic about that.
And he gives
Although,
us a story.
It's still scary to me that any one town could be 50% anything.
Yeah,
according to the map that I just posted on the blog recently, not only is Utah the majority religion all through, I mean, not only is Mormonism the majority throughout Utah, but it also spills over into the neighboring states around it.
On that map,
well, it's a really I had a hard time, not majority.
Yeah, that's the thing is that,
but I mean, you know, it is could the largest single religion. Yeah.
I'm sure it does have a majority in parts of Utah,
right.
But you know, a lot of those areas that had one denomination, that could be 15% and still be the largest one.
Okay. Yeah, it's still unnerving to me to think that
a
single city could be 50% Mormon or Catholic or Episcopalian or atheist even.
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me with some areas, like border towns in Texas.
I'm
sure most of those
towns,
are.
Some people are probably say that about Israel and Judaism.
I've got another.
Well, there's a conversation killer. I had to think about that for a second. I wasn't quite sure what you were saying.
Well,
what are you saying?
Never mind. I don't want to start an Israel discussion.
Are we at the end of the show?
Oh, I don't know. What do you got left? We're effectively running up on time, yeah.
Might start a discussion.
But that's all.
Screw it.
Screw it.
I think there were enough people who were bothered that we spent so much time talking about the animal rights thing at the beginning that giving a little extra at the end should compensate.
Well, Matt writes about, well, he works for a company that owns WWJD.com.
I responded to this guy.
Yes, you did. But I think it's interesting enough that we bring it up on the show.
I want to be very careful about,
of course,
what's in there. And we might have already.
Have I already blown it?
Yeah.
I hope not.
Well, you've gone through enough that just finished the damn story.
Well, what do you say?
I'd rather paraphrase this one
and
address the issue kind of sideways.
How is it for an let me see if I can phrase this succinctly. What are the moral ramifications of an atheist working to promote religion?
Oh, this story. Is this the one we talked about on our way to? Okay.
The guy works for a company.
So I take it he's getting paid for his technical expertise, but he doesn't agree with the message of the site.
He is the web developer for a company that is producing a large Christian socializing network site. And he had some ethical questions about it and wanted to know what my take was. And so what I did first was explain things in the terms of, if I shared your ethical dilemma.
Right.
If I really had the problem with it that you have, here's how I'd go about talking to my boss and letting them know that, you know, I still plan to do my job, but I have this problem with it, and is there anybody else we can put on the task, et cetera. The thing is, I don't share his ethical dilemma.
Right.
On the one hand, I used an analogy of being a construction contractor. Would you refuse to build a church? You're not actually promoting their religion. You're providing a service to them.
Right.
And it may, in fact, be illegal for you to deny that service to them. For example, as Schilling pointed out, the ACA is going to be looking into getting the building done. If we were in a small town where all of the construction contractors were Christians who were strongly opposed to atheists, we might be unable to find a contractor willing to do the job.
Right.
And therefore,
all those stories about pharmacists who refuse to dispense medication on the grounds that they don't agree that those medications should be allowed.
Right.
Perfect.
I think those people should do their job.
Yes.
Or should get a better job.
Yeah, or they should be free to find another job.
But,
I mean, despite my status as a loudmouth liberal, I am a strong believer in market forces, actually. I believe they should be regulated, but I believe that they exist and they form a fundamental part of understanding our economy. As a web developer, you have a skill that people are willing to pay you to perform. If you did not do it for them, then they would pay somebody else and it would still get done. There's a certain amount of demand out there for people with web skills, And you need money.
Yeah. Well, and then he could also look at it this way. If they pay him, none of that check is being tithed.
True.
If they pay somebody else, there's a good chance that that money's going to
go right back into the.
Yeah. You know, he can spend it on blowing hookers. You know, something.
As all atheists would do, of course.
Yes.
But just better that it go to an money go to an atheist. Then,
yes, an atheist who will spend it on blow and hookers.
Sometimes. Is it okay if I spend it on Dr. Pepper and books?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yes, it is. And that's it,
books? Worse than hookers.
Without referencing hookers, this is one of the things that I mentioned to him, is that you know, you can at least take some comfort in knowing that the money that you're making from it is money that's not going to further their cause. Mm-hmm. You're providing them a service so that they can do what they do. You're not doing what they do for them. And there may be some loopholes in this. For example, we use the idea of a Christian contractor refusing to build an abortion clinic. And I don't want to go into that in great detail. But the big thing is that you've got a job and you've agreed to do it, and when something distasteful comes along, if you refuse, there's a problem there. You can find another job. You have options. These people have a right to service.
And I should, you know, some companies do ask for things that are actually legally questionable, and you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, if it's within the bounds of the law, they're going to find somebody who can do it.
Well, and there's no end to the amount of jobs that can be used by religious entities. If you sell speakers and a church group comes and they want to outfit, you know, their main hall with $40,000 worth of sound equipment, you fucking sell it to them. You're not promoting it. You're just doing your job.
Yeah. Right. Somebody in the chat room made a similar comment. You know, would it be unethical for a baker to refuse to sell, you know, cookies to a Christian?
Yeah,
I mean, would you not cater a Christian event?
Of course, this is a little different because this is a guy who's working for a Christian bakery. I mean,
well, what I told him I told him how I would recommend dealing with his bosses, but that if this was really uncomfortable for him, that if he felt that the work he was doing was actually promoting something that made him uncomfortable, then he should find another job.
Yeah.
But as long as you're there, you do the job that you're supposed to do. You do the job that you've signed on to do. It would be, you know, I've gotten in fights, arguments with a number of atheists recently where we disagree on some little aspect of right. And I always tend to come out in favor of supporting individual freedoms, supporting the idea that the best way to ensure that I have the right to believe what I want to believe is helping to make sure that everybody else gets to believe.
Right. Yeah.
And that I can do that and also criticize those beliefs, and that there's nothing hypocritical about that. I can respect somebody's right to hold a belief without respecting the belief itself. I can also work to encourage them to abandon their beliefs that, in my opinion, are silly. And if they agree, great. And if they don't agree, well, it's not as great, but it's acceptable. So,
all right.
I don't know.
I
think
that's it.
I think that's. Did anybody have any last minute articles, news thingies? Sandra's awake.
Yay!
We put her to sleep every time she comes over.
Yep. Well, thanks for listening to the show. It's great you're smart enough to listen to us rather than those other stupid atheist podcasts. Figures we'd attract superior listeners. Well, since no one else can claim to be Dennis Lubé or Russell Glasser or Matt Dillahunty or Schilling, we'll expect you to wait with bated breath for our next show in 2 weeks. Until then, we leave you with Epiphany by Bad Religion.
A new age of reason, brain treason to trick the mind. What good is that?